Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10x points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Holla talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com, designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking degree downsides, credit bureau blunders, and fluctuating fast food.
You know what, buddy? This is our Friday flight where we're going to share a sampling of the top personal finance stories that we think you need to be paying attention from. Not just this past week, past 2 weeks. We were able to take a little bit of time off there at the end of last week, which means we weren't able to get around to sharing some of the newsletter referral shout-outs.
Yeah.
We recently lowered some of the bars, the threshold that was required in order to receive some of the different rewards that are available to listeners.
Some of which
out there
are literally cash money sent to you via Venmo for real, no scam.
It's a beer on us.
A beer on us. And then the coveted How to Money socks. Those are that's what people really want.
It only takes 20 referrals. Did we have it at like 30, 35?
We had it too high.
It was too high of a bar to achieve. And you know what? We've got a whole box of these socks sitting there wrapped in their socks. Fancy little plastic, and we want to get some of those out to folks. We haven't even gotten, well, I think there's a couple folks who have gotten pretty close to this, but a virtual beer hang. I'm looking forward to the first one we do.
Pretty sure Brendan's going to be the first guy to get there.
He's so close.
But, someone's going to get there at some point.
Yeah.
And we'll hang out with you for a little bit, have a beer.
Exactly. A little Zoom beer. You know, like sort of like it was like back in the pandemic days, and it was like a virtual happy hour.
That's right. Unless you actually want to fly in here, we'll do it in person, I guess.
Yeah. Hey, if you do that, beers are definitely on us. But we want to make sure that we share a few folks who shared the newsletter with their friends. And a big thanks to Emmy's mom, Austin M, V Mooney, Kyle M88, and Hassan.
Yeah.
All of y'all shared it with at least two folks, which means you're committed.
And by the way,
the How to Money
newsletter
podcast.
And we are so close to crossing 10,000 subscribers to the How to Money newsletter. So if you've been reading it, you've been getting value, share it with somebody. You might get a shout out. You might even get free money, but also you'll be helping us, you know, cross that coveted five-figure mark of people reading the newsletter. So it's our goal to send out helpful information every Tuesday. You can sign up at howtomoney.com/newsletter. But Matt, let's move on. Let's get to the Friday flight.
Let's get to the stories.
To sampling of stories we found interesting this week in the personal finance space. And like you said, we were out of town last week. We didn't have a chance to comment on what was kind of a big story in the financial space, like in like the stodgy financial space, the banking space, the Capital One,
the big bank space
takeover of Discover, that potential merger, right? And you might think, actually, when we talk about our favorite online banks, Discover and Capital One both come up.
Yeah, we like them both.
They're two of the best online banks you can choose. And so two of our favorite online banks coming together. This is a love story, a match made in heaven, right? We're super enthusiastic about this. Maybe not, though. So there's a few things to really talk about here. One, it's going to reduce competition in the banking sector, right? Economics 101 tells us that reduced competition isn't great for consumers. And the bigger banks seem to come with smaller brains. Kind of like dinosaurs, Matt. You know, the biggest dinosaurs.
The bigger they get, the dumber. It's true.
We talk about like the big three or four banks. They have a massive percentage of deposits in this country. And they are treat consumers the worst. It's the smaller, medium-sized banks that do a lot better by their customers. And so, yeah, I don't love reducing competition and taking two great banks and maybe making it into one mediocre bank. At least on the consumer banking side, this probably isn't a great thing for the American public. But there's even more to the deal than that.
I will say, though, Capital One, they did pinky promise to maintain the Discover credit cards. So at least from a credit, if you're a huge fan of your, the Discover It card, or mm-hmm. like literally, I think Discover was my first credit card when I was a teenager. This is back when you could get your own credit card as a... You don't even have to be 18 years old.
Well, Discover is actually the only, we've talked about this before, they're the only bank that has a cashback debit card. Usually you don't get paid anything for spending with your debit card.
That is true.
Discover's the only one that makes that possible.
But then the other side of the coin is that the merger could actually create more competition on the credit card payments front, posing a potential threat to the duopoly of Visa and MasterCard.
You want to explain maybe what a duopoly is?
Everyone knows what a monopoly is. Duopoly.
But how come two competing against each other, Matt, doesn't have the same impact of driving down prices?
Well, just the fact that they can go into cahoots and basically agree without agreeing.
Yeah, it's a wink-wink, nod-nod situation.
As to what it is they're going to charge folks, and these banks make a ton of money on the transaction fees that they charge different small businesses.
Yeah, and that is contributes to a greater expense for everyone.
Especially for, we heard a lot about this when it came to restaurants, which is why so many small businesses, especially restaurants, are charging much less if you skip credit cards altogether. Mm-hmm. And this could potentially result in lower swipe fees faced by businesses, which would end up helping us consumers. So it's tough to know which way the cookie's going to crumble. It makes the domino effect of this deal harder to decipher and to sort of look into the tea leaves and figure out, what's actually going to happen? Mm-hmm. We don't know. But plus, there's a solid chance that this deal doesn't even actually come to fruition because of the political climate right now. It's not all that open to big deals like this happening, to these deals taking place in the first place.
Yeah.
So we wanted to cover it because they're two huge names. They're companies that we both do business with, companies that we even recommend. But we'll see if this actually comes to fruition.
Yeah, it is interesting that the political climate might not favor this deal going through. And it's also kind of fascinating that in one sense, there might be less competition in the retail banking space. But in the other sense, in the payment processing space, there could be more competition. So is it a win for consumers? Is it not? That's like the regulators are going to weigh in on that. But I think it could be a bit of both, which makes this a tough one to figure out exactly.
Exactly.
All right, man, let's talk about careers and college for a second. A new study of more than 10 million people, so it's really thorough, not like 1,000 people, questioned on just a quick phone call, it found that roughly 50% of college graduates end up in a job that didn't require the degree that they worked really hard to get. And I feel like this reveals a lot. You know, one of the most important things it reveals is just how important your first job is, right? It doesn't have to pay a bundle, but if it's outside of your intended career path, it could have long-lasting effects on where you end up. This piece in the Wall Street Journal, talking about this new study, revealed a lot of individuals who were like, I took the first job because I couldn't find something in my career, and then I just kind of ended up staying in that place, or it took me off of that career path I was hoping to get on. This reduces pay and job satisfaction for a whole lot of folks too. And I would say this, like the biggest finding from this study that I found most fascinating is that to help ensure that you end up working in your chosen field, the biggest way to do that is to get an internship. Even if that internship...
Yeah, I love internships.
Yeah, like this is like, we say great things about internships all the time. Even, and I know some people are really hate the idea of an unpaid internship. And I would say go for the unpaid internship even too, because that is actually what's going to lead to the connections, the job history. It's the pathway, the connection and the experience you may need to get in the front door. Matt, I had an internship and a completely unpaid internship for months when I was a senior in college, but it led to me getting the exact kind of job that I wanted to get. And so that first right job, even if it's starting on the bottom of the totem pole, it's crucial to future decades of success for so many people. I think these are kind of sobering statistics about how a lot of people getting a college degree don't end up using that college degree, but I think there are ways not to be on the downside of the statistic.
Sure, yeah. I guess the one thing I didn't like about the article is that they seem to focus on a few specific anecdotes about folks who got stuck in a job, like the first job that they took out of college, mm-hmm. basically, because I think that there is totally a way to get out of a job that you find yourself in and you're just kind of like, not really loving this, or actually this, I am not using my degree.
You're less stuck than you think you are.
You are. Like, we have more control as individuals than I think folks give themselves credit for. And it's going to take a little bit of like creativity. It's going to take a little bit of initiative. It's going to take looking at problems differently. That's the kind of person that you're going to hire, even though they don't have the experience, even though their first job was, oh, what's this thing that you're Walgreens? Pharmacy? No, I was actually just like working the register.
Yeah.
I think that's totally fine, but it might just take a little bit of legwork. You can't just like follow everyone else. And like, speaking to the fact of whether or not you're going to land a great job straight out of college, I think that's another huge takeaway other than like the first job, is thinking through that. And it's just identifying and knowing that just because you go to college and get a degree, you get good grades,
more knowledge,
that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to land that amazingly paying job in the industry that you want. Like, yeah. It's just the standard default option. It's not like this conveyor belt. It's not like a moving sidewalk at a airport, and it's just going to boop, spit you out where you want to be. Yeah. Perfectly and all magically. Like, there are different things that you have to do to stand out. And like you said, I think internships are a huge way to do that. And it's great for multiple reasons, because it helps you to get a taste, like a sampling of the work that you might be doing. So for you as an individual, you're like, oh, well, maybe I didn't like that work. Well, what better way to get a feel for that than actually having gotten multiple years of schooling, paying for a degree, and then you're kind of like, well, shoot, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
Like, the sooner the better,
and
basically.
Some people just assume figure that out. That the advanced degree is going to equate to more money. And that's not always the case. You need to look into that on the front end. I've known multiple people who go through and get like their master's degree, and then, oh, wait a second, I don't know, I'm not getting paid much more for this. I thought it was going to result in like significant income increases. Maybe not, right?
And that's one of the things you can learn with an internship as you're there around other folks who are in the industry, and you're like, oh, it might take a little bit to get up to this conversational point to say, oh, how much are you making? But I love that it allows students, college, hopefully soon to be college grads, the ability to get a taste of that work. But then obviously you got the head start advantage of an internship as well, because if you are in a field that you want to be in, man, what a great way just to basically get your foot in the door.
I think what you're saying too is to be able to bob and weave in kind of today's work climate. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows this, right? That people, the jobs don't last as long. You're not necessarily employed by the same employer for 10, 20, 30 years. And so it's going to
require some of that resiliency and some of that creativity that comes with not only switching jobs, but switching even careers and industries.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think this also calls into the question, and we've talked about this at different times on the podcast too, the value of a college degree. Has the value of a college degree diminished? And I think it's a nuanced conversation, but like, when you look at the overall stats, the average college grad makes $1 million more over the course of a lifetime than the average high school grad.
That's a lot of money.
That is telling, right? But that also diminishes if you end up with the wrong degree for the career that you want. But the stats also bear out that even if you end up underemployed with a college degree, you'll still earn 25% more than the average high school graduate. Still, we would say.
Maybe not a full mill. 25% more. Though.
25%
that
more.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
And it's premium.
So much of the value proposition depends on what you study and what career path you want to take, and then how much time and money you spend acquiring that degree. Because there are a lot of degrees that people are spending six figures, Matt, to get. And those degrees just don't pan out in terms of a significantly higher salary. And then there are other people who are just cut out for trade school, for entrepreneurship, for other things where college just isn't going to be as much of a boon to their ultimate earnings.
Totally. And I think it depends too on who you're asking, or like where that person is, like what stage of life that person is in. Because I would have said in my 20s and early 30s, oh my gosh, yeah, college, total waste of time. I'm not doing something that I studied in school. But I don't know. The older you get, you kind of realize, oh, there's a more general knowledge. There's more formation taking place in college than I think you give yourself credit for, like when you are in your 20s. And now that I've gotten older, I'm like, oh no, that was actually really good for me to be there. So I think a lot of it, as to your opinion and how you feel and how you think about your degree, aside from the numbers, it also, I think, matters where you are in life, and that changes over time.
Yeah.
But dude, let's talk about the credit bureaus, credit scores in particular, because for the past 3 years, the number one complaint that the CFPB gets is credit report mistakes. And the problem has gotten pretty bad. Complaints, they have tripled in just 2 years. 500,000 folks, they have filed a complaint just last year. And there are tens of millions more who are being impacted by faulty, incorrect information on their reports, but they just haven't filed a complaint, or they're just completely unaware because you know, they're just cruising along, living life, doing their thing.
Yeah, it's amazing to think how much complaints have skyrocketed, and yet there's still a lot of people who don't pay attention to their credit score. They don't know what's on their credit report.
Exactly, yeah. So basically, something is on your credit report that shouldn't be. Experian, they settled a class action lawsuit late last year for $22 million for ruining the credit report of a ton of their customers. But, of course, this is a settlement, which means they admitted to no wrongdoing, which is pretty classic. And this problem is,
I love
just
when people pay money and then they're like, but we didn't do anything wrong.
No admission of guilt.
Then why did you pay the 22 mil if you don't feel like you did anything wrong?
Well, that's how our justice
system
works.
I would fight
works,
that thing
Joel.
If I were them, yeah.
But the problem has gotten out of hand because of the way the credit bureaus approach any sort of complaint. It's kind of like pour salt in the wound. They now have an automated system that handles the first round of disputes that get filed. And of course, it finds that your dispute has no merit.
Basically every time.
Even though it actually does. And so the truth is, roughly 25% of credit reports contain an error. So we think this is worth putting on your radar, and the big three bureaus, they're really bad at their jobs. Personally, I don't think that any additional government oversight or any additional regulation is going to bring much result. I feel like the government can barely keep the lights on without passing short-term spending bills, and they're just kicking the can down the road, which makes me think, well, okay, well, like, what are the actual alternatives? This isn't something we talk much about, but having loans, like specifically mortgages, manually underwritten is totally an alternative option. I had my very first mortgage manually underwritten, and honestly, pretty much every mortgage, like for investment properties as well, because I was self-employed. And you know, if you have irregular sources of income, they want to know all the information on you before yeah. they're like, "Oh yeah, we'll give you, we'll give you a loan." But this is something that the folks over at Ramsey, they talk about this all the time, and I think I'm going to find myself kind of barking up this tree a lot more because it is an alternative option, and it's honestly the one that seems the most viable, as opposed to waving a magical wand and fixing the system that seems to be broken and it does not seem like there is anybody that's going to hold them accountable.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, that's what the CFPB is supposed to be. They're supposed to be there to kind of help consumers and keep these financial institutions, hold them accountable.
I have less and less hope of that actually happening. Yeah. That's my problem.
In an ideal world, the credit score and the credit report would be a reflection of our financial prowess and kind of how we've done handling debt, because that helps lenders understand pretty quickly how we're going to handle a loan that they might give us, right?
Totally.
I mean, that can help a mortgage lender feel really comfortable. I'm surprised that these businesses that are buying credit scores from these bureaus aren't pushing back and saying, wait, you guys are selling us completely inaccurate information. That you would think yeah. that would be frustrating for them, because it's harder to verify when something like 20-25% of these credit bureaus contain a mistake.
Totally.
The bureaus aren't doing the job for the businesses they're supposed to serve.
It's a crappy product.
And who ends up getting screwed in the middle? It's every single consumer out there yeah. who has who's impacted by credit reports that aren't accurate.
Hey, here's a potential silver lining. Maybe this is where buy now, pay later comes to the rescue of of consumers, the ability to provide perhaps better information as they're maybe creating their own databases.
Yeah, maybe.
You never know. I'm also not counting on that actually coming to fruition.
But. Yeah, yeah. I know. It's just tough. I think like the other thing to do is to keep an eye on your credit report and on your credit score. And your score is a reflection essentially of what's on your report. So if you see your score drop 30, 40 points and you're like, wait a second, I paid everything on time. Nothing changed.
Well, what's going on there?
Dig into your credit report. You can find it for free at annualcreditreport.com. If you keep tabs on that, you have the ability then to file a dispute, to ramp things up, to file a complaint with the CFPB. Then if the credit bureaus don't respond in a helpful way once you file that complaint, which they probably won't. It sucks that this is the burden that we take on us because they're really bad yeah. at their jobs, but it is kind of the burden that we bear because the credit score and the credit report are so integral to how we function in the modern era. I'm just thinking that manual underwriting, yeah, but what if your credit score gets screwed by 40 points and you're a renter and you're trying to apply to rent a new place? Well, then you have the job explaining to that landlord, hey, guess what? I promise my credit score is actually better than this.
More hoops to jump through.
Yeah, and it's just...
But I will say landlords will actually take a look at the... Some will, exactly. I mean, I know that I would. Like, I currently have renters who had a really rough credit score, but they explain their situation, this kind of the financial hardship they experienced in the past, where they are currently, and I got to see all, you know...
There's a lot of corporate landlords who aren't as nice as you.
100%. I get that. Yeah, I guess I can't also wave my wand and expect that corporations are also going to go through the additional steps required as opposed to just simply looking at a credit score.
So I guess there's a bunch of different takeaways from this. honest. One, the credit bureaus suck. And two, you've got to watch your own back. And you can get your free credit report. There's one place, the federally sanctioned site, annualcreditreport.com. And sign up for a site maybe like Credit Karma, or maybe log in once a month to check your if your credit card allows you to get a visual on that credit score. Just follow it roughly, loosely. You don't need to be obsessed with it, but just kind of knowing generally where it is. And if there is some sort of a sudden drop, that allows you, that'll alert you to something going wrong, something that's amiss.
But we've got more stories to get to, including we've got just a fascinating scam. And you're probably thinking, oh, I don't care about scams. No, no, no. This is a really, really good scam. We're going to share it.
Hit somebody that you would normally not think it would.
I know. We'll get to that and more right after this. When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're a small business owner, listen up. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're actually choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers. They do everything from hyper-targeting best fit prospects through campaign optimization. Upswell Marketing's unique approach includes direct mail, search engine marketing, and social media ads, and has fueled more than 10,000 small business success stories. Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies. Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
All right, Matt, we're back. The Friday flight continues. More personal finance goodness to get to on this episode. We always got to get to the ludicrous headline of the week. Mm-hmm. This one comes from The New Yorker, and here's what the headline reads. The day I put $50,000 into a shoebox and handed it to a stranger, I never thought I was the kind of person to fall for a scam. Woo, Matt, this article, everyone should read this article.
$50,000.
It's fascinating, and it's ludicrous on many fronts, too. First, the story itself, just incredible. You've got to read it.
Yeah.
It's a longer, more meandering scam, which is kind of what makes it so interesting. Then the scammers are less directive and more just kind of going with the flow as they call this person and that are trying to get them to cough over some money. It's
like a case study in how to scam people.
Yeah.
Honestly.
It really is.
And like, it's good. You know, like there's hackers.
Not that we're encouraging
there's
that.
There's white hat hackers and black hat hackers or whatever. And so like you hire hackers, like an organization will, or a company, to try to penetrate your cybersecurity to let you know how it is you can improve. Read this story so that you can learn from this individual's mistakes.
That's right.
That way you can learn just how freaking good they are.
Yeah, so it starts off with like a fake Amazon employee giving you a call, attempting to verify account activity that's fraudulent. And like in this case, there was no account activity that was fraudulent, but she's like, oh, they've opened up another account in your name. And then the person who got scammed is like, what? Yeah, then that Amazon employee connects the person who wrote this article to someone at the CIA, because this kind of fraud is apparently happening regularly. And then it ends up, Matt, with the writer handing over, so sadly, $50,000 in cash that she put in a shoebox to what she thought was an undercover CIA agent. Pretty horrifying stuff. Yeah. It's again, it's worth the read. It's a complex scam, but it's just crazy to think that scams have gotten this good.
Okay, so the other the other ridiculous, ludicrous part of this article is that the person wasn't just any writer. It happened to be, and I'll share her name because obviously she published this herself.
Yeah.
I don't know how to say her last name, but her, Charlotte Cowles, I guess is how you pronounce her name. She's the financial advice columnist for The New Yorker.
And she writes for The New York Times.
Man, I certainly feel for her and felt terrible while reading this awful documentation of what she went through. But man, there are so many points along the way that red flags should have been going off. Like, I would just hope that someone with her level of money experience and sophistication just wouldn't have fallen for a scam like this. But it also reveals how good these scammers have gotten. And they're not just targeting the elderly. They often end up conning millennials and Gen Zers out there. So we want folks to be careful. This is something that can, like, if it can happen to someone who eats and breathes money, I think it can happen to almost anyone. Yeah. They slowly tightened the, I mean, man, it was so steady and incremental. And like, they were slowly removing her from reality and placing her in a reality that they had created. And before you know it,
they almost broke her brain. It was crazy.
Yeah, it was. Oh, man, it was.
It was like psychological terrorism almost.
Yes, yeah.
So you have to read the article. The case. We'll link to it in the show notes. And hopefully it's just a sad case, but it's hopefully enlightening as well. And just, these are the kinds of ways scammers can get to you now. You might think you're not susceptible. I think most of us would like to think that. But if
that's what I thought before reading this article. But then as I was reading through it, I was like, oh, that's good. Oh, man. And I would like to think that I wouldn't also fall for something like this, but I could totally see how she did.
For sure.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's move on, Matt. Let's talk about dynamic pricing. We titled this one Fluctuating Fast Food. We also could have called it Frosty Foibles, I think, because this is a Wendy's maneuver. And the thing is, dynamic pricing has been around for a long time. Basically, Wendy's is now saying, we're going to jump into the dynamic pricing sphere. And Amazon, for instance, the price of the item that you want to buy could change dozens of times in a single day. Airfare, similar price match machinations. Like, so you might try to book something in the morning and go back later that day, and the flight now costs $150 more. That's dynamic pricing at its best or worst, I guess. Ride sharing, right? Those costs vary depending on when you book too. There's surge pricing, right, that Uber has become so famous for. Well, fast food is apparently getting on this trend, specifically Wendy's. They say they're going to pilot fast food surge pricing a la Uber next year. So your burger and fries maybe cost $3 at 11 a.m. or $4.50 at noon. It just depends. You don't know what it's going to be when you walk in there. Matt, I actually think this is a bad idea for Wendy's. I think dynamic pricing,
it seems terrible.
It works really well for some industries. I don't see it working terribly well in the fast food game. Like, I could see this being far more confusing for consumers who want to know what their meal is going to cost before they head to the restaurant. I think there are potentially better ways to skin this cat for them. As a whole, I think dynamic pricing is actually a good thing for savvy consumers who are willing to pivot, willing to change their habits, willing to shop around. But in the case of fast food, I just don't see Wendy's like making out like a bandit with this.
Yeah, if you can zag while everyone else is zigging, that's when dynamic pricing, just like with airfare, if you can travel when everybody else isn't traveling, all right, well, you have the potential to totally snag a deal.
What if they just did like a generic 10% discount during those off-peak hours?
Boom.
Like, yeah.
It's just a different way of skinning the cat.
It's a better way to do it, though.
It's not how they're going about it. It's counter to, I think, what people think of with fast food. Like, when you get fast food, you want it to be quick and what else? Pretty cheap. You want it to be affordable.
Also terribly unhealthy.
And when you don't know what it's going to cost you when you go out to grab a quick lunch, I feel like it's going to backfire. Yeah. Like, it makes me think about right after college, before I knew anything about cooking food at home and eating affordably, though I was still watching my budget a decent bit. And because of that, I knew exactly what it would cost me to go to the local McDonald's, and I would get a little side salad, I would get a cheeseburger, and I'd get a yogurt parfait. Now,
that sounds like a really healthy McDonald's meal, actually.
Doesn't sound too bad. Yeah. But also, I know now that that's still a very expensive way of eating lunch versus what we do these days.
Oh, do you want to tell people what you used to do in college at the food court, at the college campus food court?
Should we... Okay, so the meal plan at UGA, pretty dang expensive, and I lived off campus. Even though we live very, very close to campus, technically I wasn't like in the dorm, didn't make sense to pay for the meal plan. However, it's like a buffet when you go there, and so I dropped $12, which is pretty expensive for a college student, but I would sit there for multiple meals and just eat all day long.
You just like literally hang out, take all your meetings in there, do all your studying in there, and just have like breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Snelling Thursdays is what we called it, because Altmix was going to be there, and everyone would come by.
Love it.
The body, it's incredible, because the way it works, you eat all this food and it stores it in your body. That's the way fat works. The fat and the vitamins and the nutrients. Anyway, all that being said, going back to McDonald's, I think I would have been far less likely to do that if I didn't know what the price was going to be. So yeah. I don't like you said, I like your approach to it. Offer a discount on some of those off-peak dining out
and
hours.
When you survey consumers, they hate the idea of surge pricing. I think, again, it makes sense for a lot of businesses, but just there's a better way to do it.
Yeah, totally. And the fact is, CEO Kirk Tanner, he was a little upset. He made it clear that he didn't actually say surge pricing. So, okay. But he definitely did talk about it as dynamic pricing, which sounds kind of similar. But okay, we occasionally rail about the subscription economy that we're living in. And there are obviously some nice things about it, right? You can cancel whenever you want. You can then, oh, actually, I see a new show's coming. I'm going to go ahead and rejoin Netflix.
Squid Game Season 2.
Yeah. It often means that we're able to remove an expensive upfront cost by being strategic. But even still, recurring subscriptions are easy to forget about. They cost the average American $219 a month, the subscriptions that we forget about. And even though we're getting something in return, because of the nature of the model, we often forget that even what we're subscribed to, which means we underestimate how many dollars we're actually wasting. But there is another subscription attempting to siphon money from us every single month, and that is the local car wash. Bloomberg, they wrote about the proliferation of car washes recently. There's a new one on our route to school that is, the girls are like, that's going to be a new car wash. I hate that they're looking
forward to it. They're going up all over the place.
That they're looking forward to it. And so instead of paying like $4, $5, $6, $7 for a wash, they want you to fork over $20 a month. And
or more.
Or yeah, or even
sometimes
more.
Sometimes 35, 40.
And I'm not gonna completely hate on the subscription car wash in particular. If you really like having a shiny car, you know, looking all fresh, that's fine. If that's your craft beer equivalent, you spend a lot of money on your car. If you park outside and it's pollen season and you got all the tree bits falling, getting caught in your air intake, I get that. That's annoying. But we just want to make sure that you are being careful for what it is that you're subscribing to.
Especially, yeah, because this Bloomberg article was talking about how many car washes are being opened. And
they're everywhere.
Private equity investors are in on the deal. One of my best friends from childhood, Matt, his dad has had a car wash for years, and I'm sure he has done quite well with it. Because and then if you opt to sell it, man, there's a lot of money in that game, too.
I get it.
But yeah. And who's paying the price for that, though? Who's making the private equity investors rich? It's the people who have the $35 a month car wash subscription.
And who aren't using it.
Yeah, especially if you're not using it. But if you're going twice a month, I don't know, maybe it's better to either pay when you do go or wash your car at home. Just saying. But let's keep talking about cars and subscriptions. There's one subscription that could end up potentially saving you money, and that is if you opted for a car subscription. Instead of owning an extra set of expensive wheels, why not maybe subscribe and reduce your overall cost of car ownership? Yeah, ownership of appreciating assets, we talk about that. That's a really good thing. When you own assets that go up in value, this is wonderful. This is increasing your net worth. But when you own assets that depreciate regularly and substantially, that's another thing. And stats find that we're only in our car driving between 3 to 5% of the time anyway. Most of the time, the car is sitting idle, whether it's in the parking lot at work, whether it's in the driveway, or the parking lot of your apartment complex, wherever it is, right? And work from home and hybrid work has reduced the need for a lot of folks to constantly have access to their own specific vehicle that they own, that they're in charge of. And there's startups like Finn out of Germany that are trying to normalize the car subscription model, which includes the cost of insurance and repairs. I think this is kind of cool, Matt, even though it might not save everybody money, but it's at least something worth looking into.
Yeah. I think what's great about this is that we're trying to point folks to thinking about things that traditionally might not be something that you'd be in favor of. But it comes down to like what the numbers.
Yeah.
But you know, like crunch the numbers, see if it makes sense for you, because I think they're talking about how technically it's more expensive even than leasing a vehicle, but it also comes with much, much shorter subscription windows.
So maybe you subscribe for a month.
And so, yeah, like technically it might be more expensive, but if it's over a shorter period of time and that means you're spending less money overall, well, then it could be a smart way of going about it. And especially like they're trying to get folks to try out EVs, and I do like the idea of knowing what you're getting into before you make a purchase. Yep. But that's also something that you can do via something like Turo or via a Zipcar. Like literally, yeah. Kate and I did that out in Colorado last year. We rented a Tesla. I was able to scratch my EV itch, get a feel for it, and avoided paying tons of money. And I don't think I would have gone out and bought a Tesla, but I was able to try that out in, I think, a more affordable way. But it's worth considering because we're not principally against something like this. It comes down to how does it work for you and how does it work out for your personal finance situation.
Yeah. You know? When you look at Finn's website, their most expensive monthly model is $1,200 a month. That's a lot of money for a car, even though it includes everything, including insurance. That's still really expensive. And so I think you're right. I think some of those pay by the hour or pay by the day. Car sharing services, Turo, Zipcar, those are worth looking into if they're in your area. Turo is basically everywhere. Zipcar is only in certain locations. But
yeah.
Or rideshare. And I think if you're able to ditch a car completely, if you actually run the numbers and see how much your car is costing you on an annual basis, and then
it's so much more.
You might
balk
at a $40 Uber ride, but ultimately that $40 Uber ride could end up saving you hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month, even though it's a more expensive way of getting from one place to another. Well, when you look at that overall perspective, it could be saving you more.
Dude, absolutely. But I guess the other part of it too, I just want to challenge folks to like think through whether or not they truly need it, and to push back on sort of the cultural expectation that we have a vehicle. Like literally yesterday, I was running home/walking home from work. Started to rain a little bit, and dude, no fewer than three people pulled over and were like, "Hey, do you need a ride?" They're folks folks I know.
You should take rides with strangers always.
And I found it to be incredibly, well, it was amazing for a couple of reasons. I guess A, it's awesome that we live in a community that it's fun to see neighbors taking care of other folks and checking in and stuff like that. But I also wish that it wasn't such a rarity to see somebody out there running home in the rain. And I wasn't like, it's not like I was like fleeing for my life. I was just like smiling and it's just drizzling a little bit. And I wish that wasn't such a rare sight for folks to consider walking home or riding their bike, because there's a much larger possibility of folks doing that than I think what's normal in our culture today is all. I don't know.
I think the number of TVs and the number of cars that we own per household is overdone. And if you can think about ways to reduce both those things in your life, I think it's a good thing. I don't know why I mentioned TVs there, but I guess it's just I just think
it seems like another one of those things. Yeah, it seems like another one of those things that you're just like, oh, why not? They certainly have gotten more and more affordable.
Yeah, it's the norm. And the norm is to have multiple cars, like often two or three in the household, right? I don't know what the average number of cars that the average household has, but it's more, for a lot of households at least, especially in today's work climate, it's a lot easier to ditch a car than ever before.
Absolutely. So, yeah. Yep.
All right, Matt, that's going to do it for this Friday flight. Hope you have a great weekend. And by the way, if you haven't gone to howtomoney.com recently, tons of new money-saving information there. Be sure to check it out. And we'll see you back here on Monday. Matt, until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.
Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
When it comes to your finances, go for the credit card that's always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night.
Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We're talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.